broke contact with them. Gallant considered defecting to the Allies, but worried that the party would kill his parents in retaliation. He confided in his girlfriend that he had a plan to spoil Goering's pleasure. That night, his girlfriend saw Gallant cleaning his pistol. 20. The Flying Sanatorium. 4 days later, January 23, 1945, Lechfeldt Air Base. Beneath the hanging lights in a vast wooden hangar, Franz sat in the cockpit of a 262, but one not attached to an aircraft. Instead, it was just a mock cockpit that sat on wheels. An instructor leaned over him with a checklist, testing Franz, who practiced emergency procedures with blinding speed, his hands flipping inoperative switches, pulling dummy levers, and calling out numbers from fake gauges. Other pilots in other mock cockpits sat around Franz, undergoing the same training. Located in southern Germany, Lechfeldt was the hub of Germany's jet training because Messerschmitt's headquarters lay in the nearby town of Augsburg. Instead of retiring to Florida, Franz had landed a slot in jet school after pestering Rodel, who secured him the appointment, one that long lines of pilots desired. But jet school was not what Franz had expected. 3 weeks into the 8-week course, he had not even sat in a real 262, and instead had flown just 2 hours of refresher flights in old twin-engine planes. Almost hourly, sleek 262s would rip past the hangar on takeoff, their twin engines blasting like rockets strapped to their wings. To their instructor's annoyance, Franz and his fellow students would forget their exercises to stop and stare. Some called the jet the Swallow, and others the Stormbird. But whenever they saw it buzz the field at 575 miles per hour, faster than anything else in the skies, they knew the 262 was Germany's last hope. An instructor stopped the class and shouted for the students to gather around. The instructor read Franz and the others a teletype sent from Goering to all Air Force units. It said that Gallant, the general of fighters, had stepped down due to health problems. Franz scowled, having heard rumors that said Goering had sacked Gallant. Goering had written the announcement weeks prior, but had held it, waiting for the Gestapo to bring him evidence against Gallant. Now they'd found witnesses who would testify that Gallant had admitted the war is lost. These words, coming from a general, constituted treachery under the subversion law. Goering knew that Gallant would kill himself rather than face the shame of a trial, so he sent the notice to the fighter forces to prepare them for the general's death. While the words of Goering's memo were still swirling in Franz's mind, across Germany, Gallant was loading his pistol. He had told his girlfriend, "Tonight will be the night," and she fled his house. Gallant spent the rest of the day pondering how Goering and the party's propaganda machine would spin his death. When they forced the Desert Fox, Rommel, to kill himself, they said he died of an embolism. When Goering pushed General Ernst Udet, Germany's top surviving World War I ace, to kill himself, they said he died in a plane crash. When General Hans Jeschenek, Goering's chief of staff, shot himself, they said it was from fatigue. That night, before Gallant could pull the trigger, his phone rang. Gallant picked up. The caller was the chief of the Gestapo, who begged Gallant not to shoot himself. Hitler had learned of Gallant's intentions via his girlfriend's pleas, and now Hitler was enraged at Goering. Hitler was certain that the fallout from Gallant's death would destroy the Air Force in its fragile state. The dictator had ordered Goering to stop Gallant's suicide, so Goering had ordered the Gestapo to intervene. The Gestapo chief told Gallant that Hitler and Goering had a proposal he needed to hear. Several days later, Gallant stepped from his sports car at Goering's country estate, called Karrenhall, that lay east of Berlin. Goering was suspiciously gracious as he showed Gallant to a great room, its walls lined with the mounted heads of wild game. He invited Gallant to sit on a couch and talked with him like an old friend. Goering took credit for intervening to prevent Gallant's suicide and dismissed any rumors of treason charges. Goering gleefully explained that Hitler had authorized him to give Gallant a squadron of his own. "So you can prove what you've always said about the 262's great potential." Gallant's dark eyes sparkled. Goering said the squadron could fly and fight in the manner of Gallant's choosing, as long as he did not interfere with other units.
"You can recruit anyone you want," Goering added, "provided that my office approves of them."
Gallant nodded in agreement.
"Take that sad sack, Steinhoff,"
Goering said with a grin.
"And Lutzel, too."
Gallant left Goering's estate as happy as the Reichsmarschall. He knew why Goering and Hitler were being so generous. They wanted him and his traitors to again take to the skies, where they would surely die in combat. Gallant had admitted that the war was lost, and he did not want to see it prolonged. But he also knew the Allied heavy bombers would not stop coming until Germany had surrendered, a day that seemed far away with the madmen, Hitler and Goering, at the helm. Goering had told the people of Germany that the fighter pilots had abandoned them, but Gallant departed that day determined to prove that Goering was wrong. 2 months later, March 17th, 1945. In the hangar at Lechfeld, a dozen pilots huddled around Franz as he gave a lesson about a jet engine that sat on a mount in front of him. One of the pilots asked if Franz could show them the engine's insides.
"I wish," Franz said, "but there are parts you're not allowed to see."
The students groaned. Franz sympathized with them. After graduation from jet training, the school's instructors had kept Franz on the roster to teach because he had mastered the 262 so quickly. Franz owed his success to his airline days, where he flew multi-engine craft, unlike the average fighter pilot who had only single-engine training. Upon graduation, Franz had hoped to join a jet fighter unit, but only the jet bomber units, who had Goering's favor, possessed planes, fuel, and openings for pilots. Rather than join them, Franz begrudgingly stayed as an instructor and waited. Unlike his earlier days in flight instructing, Franz's students were no longer cadets. Now they were veteran fighter and bomber pilots. Franz explained to the pilots that the 262's revolutionary Junkers-built Jumo 004 engines were both the jet's gift and its curse. They provided incredible thrust, but they were finicky.
"Keep your hands off the throttle whenever possible," Franz told the pilots, "especially at high altitude."
The men looked at him with confusion. Every pilot knew the importance of using the throttle in a dogfight. Franz explained that dramatic changes in the engine's internal speed could cause it to snuff out like a candle. When the pilots asked Franz why this happened, he said that he was forbidden from telling them how the engine actually worked.
"It's secret," he said mockingly.
The pilots laughed. Really, Franz knew the engines were as fragile as China because they were made from low-grade materials due to mineral shortages. Some of the 262's parts were actually made by slave laborers in underground factories, a Third Reich crime against the workers that also put the pilots of such jets in danger of flying a sabotaged or poorly constructed machine. A brand new engine had a lifespan of just 28 hours, and refurbished engines were good for just 10 hours between overhauls. That night in the Lechfeld Officers Club, Franz was talking and drinking with his students. One of them was a new pilot who had been trained to fly bombers but had never entered combat.
"What's it really like out there?"
he asked Franz. Franz told him candidly what he had seen the prior fall when he was stationed near Dresden.
"Be thankful for this training," Franz told the young pilot. "It takes 8 weeks to teach you what you could learn in an hour."
The pilots laughed in agreement. Franz was taking another drink when it hit him.
"Here we are studying engine manuals, while our comrades are being slaughtered," he said.
The veterans nodded in sad agreement. Just as the political officers made their way into front-line squadrons, they also were embedded in jet school. The following morning, Franz found himself standing at attention in his commander's office. The new pilot Franz had been talking to the night before had secretly been a political officer. Without a choice, Franz's commander expelled him from the school. Outside his commander's office, Franz looked at his doctor's waiver, his ticket to Florida. Then he remembered the whispers he had heard among his fellow instructors. They had heard that Gallant and his mutineers were forming a 262 squadron at Brandenburg Air Base, west of Berlin. The instructors jokingly called the unit the Flying Sanatorium and Gallant's Circus. But Franz knew Gallant, the man behind the unit, and knew there was nothing funny about him. In the school's office, Franz called Brandenburg and eventually reached Gallant. He asked the general if he could join his squadron.
"Yes, we'd be glad to have you," Gallant said.
He explained a catch. Goering had given him authority to build a squadron, but gave him too few aircraft to succeed.
"Just bring a jet with you,"
Gallant told Franz. Franz's heart sunk. He knew it was impossible to procure a jet without orders. Thinking quickly, Franz asked Gallant if his unit had a name.
JV-44,
Gallant told him. Franz told the general he would try to join him somehow. No one knows exactly why Gallant chose the designation Jagdverband 44, JV-44, or Fighter Band 44, although many suggest it was his tongue-in-cheek reference to the year 1944, when Goering had destroyed the fighter forces. Franz had an enlisted man drive him from Lechfeld to the town of Leipheim, an hour west. Leipheim was nestled around a factory that churned out 262s and had its own airfield. In the factory's parking lot, Franz suited up in his flight gear. Smoke billowed from the factory following a raid that morning by B-24s of the 467th Bomb Group. The Bomb Group's PR officer would write of the raid, "It's daily more apparent that the Luftwaffe's last stand relies on racy jet-propelled fighters. The surest place to smash them is in the incubator. That's why the attack on Leipheim, assembly and testing center for ME-262s, represents a gigantic air battle, won before the breathless Jerry could swing his saved-up Sunday punch." Inside, on the production line, he saw only one intact 262 sitting on its gear. The jet's smooth body was painted gray like a shark, and white putty filled its seams. Hastily painted black crosses decorated its flanks and wings. The factory foreman approached Franz and asked if he could assist him.
"I'm here on orders to collect an aircraft for Gallant's unit, JV-44,
Franz said. Puzzled, the foreman checked his lists. He said he had no such transfer orders and had never heard of JV-44. Seeing that his bluff was not working, Franz admitted the truth to the foreman, that he had no orders or papers. Franz told the foreman that Gallant was forming a squadron of aces who had volunteered to fly against the bombers. The foreman scratched his chin, pondering Franz's admission. Seeing his opportunity fading, Franz asked the foreman,
"What would be better, letting me take this into the sky or seeing it destroyed here in the next raid?"
The foreman looked at the beautiful machine and the smoldering plant behind it.
"I think I found your paperwork," he said with a smile.
Franz called Brandenburg and reached JV-44 to ask the weather and tell them he was coming. Bulldozers were repairing the factory's runway as Franz taxied the gray jet between bomb craters. With a roar, Franz blasted off in the machine with the pulsing engines, the craft said to be Germany's last hope. He steered northeast to join the Flying Sanatorium. 45 minutes later, over Brandenburg Air Base. From above, Franz admired the circular flak towers that surrounded the airfield, spires that kept away enemy fighters. When his wheels touched down, he taxied toward the control tower and hangars, where dozens of 262s sat parked in lines. But the air traffic controllers radioed him to say he was heading to the wrong place. JV-44 was across the field. So Franz cut across the runway and motored toward the distant tree line,
where 10 or so 262s sat parked in front of a small one-story office. Franz shut down his jet and slid from the wing. Half the jets around him were missing engines. The flight line looked more like a boneyard.
"I'm in the wrong place," Franz said to the first crewman who approached him. "Where's JV-44?
"You're in the right place, sir," the man replied. "This is JV-44. Confused, Franz asked where Gallant was, but the crewman just shrugged. A man emerged from the ops office and approached Franz. He wore flying boots and black pilot's pants, but oddly also a knit sweater and skullcap. The man's arms dangled, and he walked with a lean. Franz thought he looked like a sailor navigating a tossing deck. When the man came closer, Franz saw that long strands of blonde hair shot from beneath the man's skullcap, covering his eyes. Franz became certain the man was a sailor.
"Beautiful machine," the man said.
He flashed a large grin across his strong, deep jaw. He wore the rank of a major.
"An hour old,"
Franz said proudly, saluting. The man saluted with gusto and introduced himself as Major Eric Hohagen, JV-44's technical officer. Franz knew the technical officer was effectively third in command and in charge of keeping the aircraft operational. Franz had heard of Hohagen. He was an Air Force legend. As Hohagen patted Franz's 262 like a horse, Franz saw for himself that the stories about Hohagen were true. His right eyebrow arched higher than his left one, giving his face a permanent quizzical expression. Hohagen had been shot down in 43, and in the crash, his head had hit his gun sight, shattering his skull. With no other options, doctors had replaced his broken skull pieces with plexiglass before sewing him back up, leaving his face forever uneven. Hohagen asked Franz how he had come to join the unit. Franz explained that he knew Gallant from Sicily and recently got booted from jet school courtesy of a political officer.
"So, you don't sleep well with the party?"
Hohagen asked. Franz laughed. Hohagen asked how he was to know Franz was not a political officer himself. Franz shrugged. Hohagen told Franz a joke that he called the political officer test. "Hitler, Goering, Himmler, and all of their friends are out on a boat at sea," Hohagen said.
"There's a big storm, and their boat sinks. Who's saved?"
Hohagen's mouth remained agape, as if he wanted to give the answer himself. Franz knew the joke.
"Germany."
Hohagen roared with approval. He explained that no political officer would have the stomach to finish the joke. Franz chuckled at the irony that the man he had thought was a sailor had told him a joke about the sea. Throughout the Air Force, Hohagen was known for his colorful spirit, for flying in a yellow leather coat with a fox fur collar, and for wearing boots topped with fur. Hohagen was anything but a clown in the air, and had 50-odd victories to his name. Unsettled by the paltry image of JV-44 around him, Franz asked where everyone was. Hohagen explained that JV-44 was off to a slow start. The unit had about a dozen pilots. A third of their jets were broken because they had been drawing refurbished planes from factory repair lines. They had no base housing and lived in private homes. Their motor pool was Gallant's BMW sports car, Steinhoff's DKW motorcycle, and a few Kubelwagens.
"Can you draw support from JG-7?
Franz asked, having seen Fighter Wing 7, one of the few jet fighter outfits across the field. Hohagen explained that he had served under Steinhoff in JG-7 until Steinhoff was fired. Hohagen said that he, personally, had led Third Group across the field, but the man who took his job, Rudy Zinner, could do nothing to help. They had already asked. Goering had forbidden anyone from assisting JV-44, the mutineers. Franz's ears perked up. He told Hohagen he knew Zinner from Africa.
"You can go over there," Hohagen told Franz, "but I cannot."
Franz was confused. Hohagen explained that he had been so angry when Steinhoff was fired that he trashed his office, destroying the place in protest. Before he could be arrested, he called the flight doctor and told him to hurry quickly because his head wounds were making him crazy. Instead of a court-martial, he was banished to the hospital, from which Gallant and Steinhoff retrieved him for JB-44. What Hohagen failed to mention was that to protest Göring's treatment of Steinhoff, he also stopped wearing his Knight's Cross that day, except for photos. Franz removed his cap and showed Hohagen the dent in his forehead. Hohagen removed his cap and showed Franz the massive scar in his. They compared their doctor's certificates and instantly bonded. Later that afternoon, a BMW sports car pulled up to the office. Gallant and Steinhoff emerged from the car, grumbling from a fruitless trip in search of pilots. Gallant had chosen Steinhoff as his number two man, the operations officer who would oversee training and recruiting when not leading missions.
"You must have pissed someone off," Gallant said when he saw Franz.
Franz smiled guiltily as he saluted. Gallant explained that he had wired Franz's name to Berlin, and no one protested his attempt to join the unit. Gallant said that Göring was blocking many of his pilot requests and only allowing men to stay with JB-44 if they had run afoul of him or the party. Göring wanted the mutineers to fly long enough to die, not to consume the Air Force's last veterans and precious aircraft. Franz asked Gallant,
"Will your brother be joining us?"
"No, he's dead," Gallant said. Franz remembered from their meeting in Sicily that Gallant had lost one brother, but had another who was still flying fighters.
"No, the other one, who was flying 190s,
Franz said.
"They're both dead,"
Gallant said as calmly as if he were ordering a cup of tea.
"Wutz joined Paul in the afterlife more than a year ago."
Franz apologized, but Gallant cut him off.
"Don't apologize when you're coming from the same place."
Franz realized that Gallant had remembered his stories of August from their conversation in Sicily. At that moment, Franz's doubts of the meager unit vanished. Regardless of JB-44's strength or success, he knew that they were all fighting for the same thing. Not for the Reich, for their brothers. During his first week in the unit, Franz and the others waited around Brandenburg. Gallant departed one morning in his sports car, motoring south. Steinhoff said the general had gone to find JV-44 a new base, as far from Berlin as possible. The American and Soviet armies were driving to link up and separate the top half of Germany from the bottom half. Gallant wanted his unit to be on the American side, not the Soviet side, when the curtain came down. Franz watched as ground crewmen painted his naked fighter a wavy, mottled green that covered the black Air Force crosses on its flanks. In place of each black cross, they painted the white outline of a cross, and on both of the plane's flanks they painted a white number 3. One night, Franz snuck across the airfield to visit Zinner, who welcomed him into his office. Franz was astounded that Zinner, in the nearly 2 years since he had seen him in Sicily, had never earned the Knight's Cross. Zinner, who always called himself just an ordinary soldier, laughed it off. Franz knew Zinner was anything but ordinary. He had nearly 40 victories, and had been shot down 11 times.
"So sad about the bear, isn't it?" Zinner said.
Franz fell back in his seat. He knew Zinner was talking about Bobby, the Squadron 6 mascot. Zinner told Franz that he had heard their old squadron had been so torn up in the fighting that during their retreat to central Germany they needed to leave the bear behind. They could not release the bear into the wild because he had been raised by humans and did not know how to hunt. Since the bear had come to weigh 400 pounds, he was too heavy to transport. When the zoo would not take the bear back, the squadron had no other options. The squadron pilots and ground crew could not bring themselves to do what had to be done. Franz looked away, afraid to hear the rest.
"They handed the bear to a neighboring unit that led it into the woods and shot it," Zinner said.
Franz sat, unmoving and unblinking. Zinner saw this and put a sympathetic hand on his shoulder.
Franz would later think how silly it must have looked, a grown man grieving over an animal. But to Franz, the killing of his bear was symbolic of so much more than just one death. As he had once told the pool manager in Wiesbaden, the bear never bit anyone. Several days later, March 31st, 1945. Beginning at dawn, Steinhoff led JV-44 into the air for the unit's first mission en masse. Gallant had found them a new base at the Munich airport, far from Berlin. Franz and eight other pilots followed Steinhoff south. As the Autobahn passed beneath his jet's wings, Franz saw that the elegant roadways were strangely empty. German civilians lacked gasoline. Most fighter units had disintegrated, too, from lack of fuel, and their personnel were transferred to the infantry. Franz knew, however, that the forests bordering the highway still contained life. There, the last of the Air Force operated. Units now parked their fighters and even four-engine bombers under the pine trees. Side roads served as taxiways, the Autobahn as a runway. Mechanics repaired engines on wood benches, and fighters hid beneath underpasses between takeoffs. The once gentlemanly black-tie Air Force now operated like partisans. Racing from Berlin to escape the Allies and the grasp of the party, the men of JV-44 felt a rush of freedom. They sensed that they were the last squadron of the Air Force, the last knights in a crumbling realm. When the flights arrived over Munich, they steered east to the airfield. From the air, the field looked like an oval racetrack for horses. At the north end, the terminal and hangars curved like a reviewing stand around a concrete parking area for aircraft. A vast oval of grass ran east to west, where planes would take off. Franz knew this field from his airline days. As he flew lower, he saw that the white terminal's classical architecture had been marred. Franz could see through the roof's burned beams to pools of water where passengers once had sat. The control tower still stood from the second story of the terminal, but its glass had been shattered. Franz landed and taxied to a halt in a line with the others in front of the field's two damaged hangars. The pilots anxiously scanned the skies, expecting to see the Allied fighters that now flew from bases in France and Belgium. With endless numbers and fuel, the P-38s, P-47s, Spitfires, and plentiful P-51s orbited over Germany, their shadows challenging any German pilot to come up to fight. Gallant greeted his men and assured them they were safe at Munich because no one knew they were there. Yet. The next morning, April 1, 1945, dawned with optimism as Franz and his comrades reported to the unit's new headquarters, a tall, castle-like building 2 miles south of the field. The vacated building had been an orphanage once, but the children were long gone, now tucked away in safer territories. The pilots hung their pistols side by side on coat racks and ate breakfast together in a long dining hall beneath chandeliers. An outline on the wall marked where a large crucifix had once hung. At their morning meal together, the men sat wherever they wished, sergeant next to general. Gallant had returned to his old charisma, and Steinhoff toasted the unit. A forlorn little troop of the outcast and condemned. The prior night, the pilots had settled into the village of Feldkirchen, just east of the airfield, where German families loaned bedrooms to them. Gallant had chosen quarters more befitting a general, on the fringe of town, where he moved into an Alpine-style lodge. The men of JV-44 wasted no time preparing for battle. They set up their headquarters in the abandoned orphanage and spread a large war map across a table in the center of the room. Over the map, they laid a sheet of glass with grids. The map showed southern Germany and northern Austria, the areas that Gallant intended JV-44 to defend. A red line on the map showed the shrinking front lines. The Americans would reach southern Germany first. They were now gaining 50 miles of territory per day. On the airfield grounds, the pilots found an old shed in the northeast corner that they turned into an alert shack where they could gather between missions. Technicians strung a telephone line from the alert shack to the orphanage in order to coordinate flights. In the fresh light of spring, the men draped green camouflage netting over the shack's roof. They arranged white lawn chairs and small circular tables on the side of the shack that faced the airfield. Between the shack and the terminal were blast pens. For easy access, the pilots taxied their jets up to the pens and shut down their engines. Hopping out, they helped their mechanics push the jets backward into the earthen half-moon enclosures. A long-nosed FW-190D fighter landed on the field as the men worked. The 190D taxied to the empty terminal. Nicknamed the Dora, the 190D had an elegant profile and a long inline engine, where a fat radial had once sat. At the empty terminal, the plane stopped, the pilot unsure where to go. The plane then turned around and taxied across the field, stopping at the alert shack. The Dora's pilot climbed out and glanced around, clearly disoriented. He wore a long black leather coat and a forage cap. The men laughed until they realized who he was. He was Colonel Trotloft. The colonel walked closer and greeted his fellow outcasts and mutineers. Gallant drove over from the orphanage to greet Trotloft, who slipped the general a list of places where he could find the supplies he needed to build JV-44. As quickly as he had arrived, Trotloft hopped in his Dora and flew away to work for Gallant in secret. Gallant and Steinhoff looked at the list. They knew that jets and supplies were useless without pilots. Their recruiting efforts had floundered thus far due to Goering's interference, so they decided to take more drastic measures. That evening, they drove to the fighter pilot's rest home, Florida. They had heard rumors that one of Germany's top pilots was recuperating there, a man with 195 victories to his name. The next morning, that pilot took a seat at the unit's table during breakfast. He was Captain Walter the Count Krupinski. He had been Steinhoff's wingman on the Eastern Front. The Count looked more Polish than German, having been born near the Polish border. His forehead was wide, his chin was strong, and his brown eyes were round and friendly. He wore riding pants with wide flares to play up to his nickname, one given by his comrades because he had expensive taste in wine, but came from humble origins. He was actually the son of a soldier. Though the Count had a loud reputation, the ace who took his seat at JV-44's table was a quieter version of himself. He had checked into Florida to recover from burns sustained the prior August, and to mourn. 5 months earlier, his younger brother Paul had died in a U-boat off the Norwegian coast. Ever since he lost his brother, the Count's eyes no longer flickered with mischief. "He loved life itself," a German propaganda postcard had once boasted of him, the aristocratic hero of the common folk who now wore the Knight's Cross. Before his brother had been killed, the Count had loved wine, women, and song. A year prior, he and Germany's top ace, Lieutenant Erich Bubi Hartmann, had been summoned to Berchtesgaden in southeastern Germany to receive decorations from Hitler. Hartmann's comrades called him Bubi, or Little Boy, because he had a childlike face, bright blue eyes, and thick blonde hair. The night before the ceremony, the Count and Hartmann celebrated their momentary freedom from the war by drinking champagne and mixing it with cognac. The next day, drunk on their feet, they reported to Hitler. When the dictator dangled new knight's crosses with oak leaves around their necks, the pilots wobbled, unable to stand rigid. The Count had trouble clicking his heels to greet Hitler because he was fighting the urge to vomit. Hitler stopped momentarily when he smelled the booze seeping from the Count's pores. After they had received their awards, the Count thought a cigarette would settle him down. He forgot that Hitler did not drink or smoke, and pulled out his silver cigarette case to light up. Hitler saw this and told him to stop his disgusting habit. Instead of punishing his drunken pilots, Hitler regaled them with his plans to reverse the losing tide on the Eastern Front. After the Count and Hartmann left the ceremony, they both needed another drink. "He's a raving lunatic," the Count had said of Hitler. Hartmann chided him. "I told you so. I told you so." When Franz met the Count that morning, he knew that behind the legendary pilot's relaxed demeanor, he carried a heavy secret. Ruddle had told Franz how the Count had watched Steinhoff dispatch the Soviet pilot trapped in his burning fighter, and had agreed to Steinhoff's request to shoot him if he was ever in a similar predicament. All pilots feared a fiery death. Franz had been burned in Sicily. The Count had been burned in a crash the prior August. But Franz wondered if the Count knew of the 262's reputation for burning. He doubted the Count knew that the jet's fuel was made from kerosene derived from coal, fuel housed in tanks in front of, behind, and below the pilot seat. Franz had heard Gallant bragging to the men who had not flown the 262, "It's as if angels are pushing you." Franz knew that he and the pilots around him had outlived their 9 lives. On the eve of battle, a new question troubled Franz. What happens when the angels stop pushing? The next morning, April 2nd, 1945. The pilots of JV-44 stood high on a blast pen surrounding the 262 on the ground. They looked down and marveled that the slender jet looked wider and shorter from above. There were 20 of them, all the pilots in JV-44. Only 9 were officers like Franz. Each had flown a lifetime in combat hours, but some, like the Count, had never even sat in a jet. By unspoken agreement, they all wore the same classic black leather jackets and flying pants to summon all the machismo as they could muster. In the blast pen beneath his pilots, Gallant leaned against the wall, his arms folded. In his place, Steinhoff, Franz, and Hohagen taught the lesson. While Franz and Hohagen stood along the leading edge of the 262's wing, Steinhoff paced back and forth atop the wing with a pointer stick. Even those pilots who had flown the 262 listened, because the 262 was a dangerous machine that a pilot could never fully master. Steinhoff told the men that landing the 262 was the most dangerous moment of a flight. In the 262, a pilot had to commit to the approach and stick with it. Due to the engine's tendency to snuff out with quick throttle movements, a pilot could not pour on the coals to recover from a bad approach. Instead, he had to anticipate any speed changes far in advance. Having instructed in the 262, Franz knew the engines better than anyone. In jet school, the rules had forbidden him from telling his students anything about the engine's inner workings. Now, with his comrades listening intently, Franz revealed the engine's secret flaw. He told them the engine's fan blades were made from inferior metals that could not resist heat the way they should. Germany could no longer access minerals like cobalt and nickel to make strong blades. If a pilot throttled forward too quickly, heat would build in the engine and melt the blades.
"It won't always kill you," Franz said. "It will kill the next guy."
He explained that the blades would cool and crack after the engine cooled down, usually once on the ground. On the next flight, the blades would be primed to shatter, resulting in catastrophic engine failure. Franz's comrades nodded. Franz knew he, Steinhoff, and Hohagen were trying to teach in a day what he had usually taught in 8 weeks of jet school. But the men standing above him were no ordinary pilots. The sight of his pilots standing on the blast pen inspired Gallant to take Trautloft's list and go to work. Goering and Hitler often derogatorily called Gallant the actor, but like a movie star with far-reaching connections, Gallant shined up his charm and called in favors, siphoning supplies from the Air Force to JV-44. HE-111 bombers arrived from factories in northern Germany and unloaded experimental underwing rockets. Trucks pulled up and dumped crates of UMO-004 jet engines. Near the hangars, tanker trucks filled the airfield's underground fuel tank with kerosene jet fuel. Gallant sent his pilots to factories, and they flew back in refurbished 262s. The Count's name on JV-44's roster helped Steinhoff's recruiting. Whispers began floating among Germany's remaining fighter squadrons that the Count had cast his lot with the mutineers. Pilots began sneaking away from their units to join JV-44, and combat-proven instructors in Trautluft's flying school asked to transfer to Gallant. Trautluft obliged, secretly funneling them under Goering's nose. Franz remarked to Gallant that Marseille would have joined the unit. Gallant agreed, but reminded Franz of Marseille's disregard for the party and all things military. "He never would have lasted this long," Gallant said. Franz nodded at Gallant's compliment to Marseille. A rumor began that to join JV-44, a pilot had to wear the Knight's Cross. When Franz heard this, he laughed, because only a black tie decorated his neck. 21. We are the Air Force. 3 days later, April 5th, 1945, 9:30 a.m. The cold sun seemed barely to rise above the airfield as Franz and his comrades lounged around the alert shed in their flight gear. The ground around them glittered with frost. The pilots nervously smoked cigarettes and leaned back in their straight-legged chairs, acting nonchalant. Hohagen stood along a window of the alert shack with his ear glued to a field phone. Unlike the others, he was not dressed to fly, because he was coordinating the day's operations. Every few minutes, he relayed a message from the orphanage, the grid coordinates of the four motors, a countdown as the bombers neared southern Germany. Franz and his comrades knew that 1,000 four motors and 600 escort fighters were coming. The radar men had been tracking them since they departed England, and now spotter girls were monitoring them with field glasses. Franz and the others were eager to fly on what would be JV-44's first combat mission in strength from its new base. It would not be the unit's baptism of fire, however. 3 days earlier, just hours after he had learned to fly the 262, the Count had taken a jet to Buzz, Florida, and show his friends he was back in the cockpit. During his flight, the orphanage radioed him to tell him to come home because P-38s had been spotted nearby. Instead, the Count had attacked the P-38s, thinking it would be nice to score on his first mission. But he overestimated his speed, overshot the P-38s, and fired wildly, his shots missing. Now the Count sat next to Franz, his knees bouncing. Other pilots paced. Franz felt the same anxiety, a new worry he had never faced in the war, the question of who would be chosen to fly. Out of the unit's 18 planes, half sat without engines in the blast pens. Their engines were in nearby villages, at auto shops, where mechanics repaired them with tools once used to fix cars. Only 7 planes were flyable. When Gallant and Steinhoff approached, dressed to fly, Franz saw them with relief. The waiting was over. The pilots snapped to attention, but Gallant told them to relax. Unfolding a map on a table, Gallant told the men to gather around. Using his finger, he explained that the bomber stream had split into small elements to hit multiple targets across southern Germany. He tapped the map. Steinhoff would take off first and lead a flight of the 5 most reliable jets to intercept the bombers east of Munich. Gallant would lead a separate mission afterward of whatever jets remained flightworthy. Steinhoff announced the pilots who would fly with him. Count, Lieutenant Farman, Lieutenant Stiegler, Sergeant Nielinger. And that was all. Hohagen shouted new grid coordinates to Gallant. The 4 motors were within range. Gallant reminded his pilots what they already knew. Hundreds of escort fighters would be waiting for them. He told them what they tried to forget, that jet pilots had become the Allied fighters' top targets, both in the air and in their parachutes. As the war wound down, American fighter pilots knew that any German pilot still flying had to be an expert. This awareness led some American pilots, a small, unknown percentage, to shoot German pilots in their parachutes or after landing. Their logic was pragmatic. They did not want a German expert returning to the skies to kill a 10-man bomber crew, a buddy, or them. Gallant had just heard from Fighter Wing 7 that one of their pilots, Major Rudy Zinner, had been strafed the day before, after bailing out. Mustangs had shot up Zinner's jet, and he was badly burned in the fire. After he had bailed out, he landed in a farmer's field, tangled in his chute. The Mustangs came back around and strafed him, but missed. Zinner played dead until they left. He was injured, but alive. Someone lamented aloud,
"So don't bail out, because they'll strafe you in your chute. But don't crash, or they'll strafe you on the ground. What's a guy to do?"
"Don't get shot down," Front said, half-joking.
The other pilots chuckled. Gallant did not laugh. His straight face killed the other's amusement. As general of fighters, he had seen the bodies of pilots who had been hit by 50-caliber bullets while floating down in their chutes. They landed weighing half the weight they had been when they jumped. During the Battle of Britain, Hitler had considered ordering German pilots to shoot their enemies in parachutes. Hitler asked Goering how he thought the order would go over, and Goering sought out Gallant's opinion.
"I should regard it as murder, Herr Reichsmarschall,"
Gallant told Goering, and he promised to disobey such an order, if it was ever issued. Goering smiled and said,
"That is just the reply I had expected from you, Gallant."
Due to Gallant's steadfastness to his code, Hitler never issued the order. Hohagen relayed word to Steinhoff. It was time to launch. Gallant dismissed the pilots with a salute. Steinhoff called Franz and the others of his flight together. Steinhoff at once admitted that attacking the heavies was something like controlled suicide, but now he tried to inspire his men. He said he had been listening to the bombers on a radio at the orphanage and could hear their pilots talking between planes. They no longer bothered with radio silence, assuming that the German Air Force was finished.
"Let's prove them wrong," Steinhoff said.
Green flares arced across the field. With the tower vacant, this was the signal for ground personnel to clear the runway. From the cockpit of White 3, through its headset, Franz heard Steinhoff's voice telling him and the others to ignore the flares and wait until their engines were warm. Franz found himself looking over his shoulder, hoping enemy fighters did not swoop down on the field. He removed his gloves and passed his rosary beads between his fingers. Only specks of black paint remained on the pale purple beads. After 5 minutes that seemed like 5 years, Steinhoff began his takeoff roll, followed by the count and the others. Franz dropped his rosary beads into his chest pocket and zipped it shut. He slipped on his gloves and gently pushed the throttle forward. Orange flames in the shape of cones throbbed from his engine's exhausts. White 3 rolled along the runway's grass, leaving in its wake a hazy cloud that smelled like coal. The 262 shrieked like a banshee and built speed slowly, its three wheels spinning into a blur as the runway whipped past. Franz knew that the 262 required 2,000 yards to reach its liftoff speed of 120 miles per hour, so he held the stick neutral to keep the nose down. Ahead, Franz saw the airfield's tree-lined perimeter growing closer. Beyond lay the steeples and rooftops of the village of Feldkirchen. Pulling back on the stick, Franz lifted the plane's nose. The jet hesitated, its nose wheel dragging through the air before the whole machine floated upward. Small trees whipped beneath the jet's spinning tires. With its gear sucked into its stomach, the jet began to sprint, sucking air into turbojets that heated the air and spit out thrust. Unlike the 109's engine torque, the 262's engines pushed together, resulting in straight speed. The flight of five aimed toward the northeast and flew low to build their speed before climbing. The skies around them were empty. Franz suddenly believed what Steinhoff meant when he said, "We are the Air Force." Through his jet's plastic bubble canopy, Franz saw Bavaria around him. The countryside sparkled as the snow melted to reveal spring's green pastures.
"An ugly war has never been fought in a more beautiful place," he thought.
Blistering along at 475 miles per hour, the flight blasted over the female flak gunners who manned the guns around the airfield. The pilots called them fighter dolls. The formation whistled over battered villages, where women, children, and old men scurried to catch a glimpse. They passed over columns of German refugees, some of the nation's 2 million homeless, who now camped in villages and alongside country roads. The flight ripped across the Autobahn, their engines' thunder echoing along the concrete, calling out the beaten pilots and tired mechanics from beneath the trees where they waited to surrender. The men stepped to the road and stared wide-eyed at the jets that raced across the pines, trailing a snarling roar of defiance that quickened their hearts. The people on the ground held their hands over their eyes, fixated at the sight of the 5 jets climbing toward the sun. Some wept with pride, and others with sadness. Some shook their heads with scorn at such futile stubbornness. But everyone who watched the 5 jets knew they were going off to battle an overwhelming foe. They saw for themselves that Goering was wrong. The Air Force had never abandoned them. They had seen the Air Force and more, something that Goering had told them no longer existed in German skies. Bravery. 32,000 feet above the earth. From his place at the right rear of the triangle formation, Franz heard Steinhoff call out the bombers with elation. Steinhoff banked the formation northward to the left, and Franz saw the heavies. They flew like a wispy silver cloud above the patchwork fields. His eyes lit up. The cloud of bombers was tiny, just 30-odd planes, and appeared to be floating westward between the cities of Straubing and Ingolstadt. Compared with the 2,000 bomber raids the Americans had been sending, 30 bombers was nothing. Steinhoff began his 500-mile-per-hour charge. The attack method in the 262 had changed to compensate for the jet's blazing speed. The days of dive, hit, climb, and repeat had passed. Now, Franz knew to make a sprint for the bombers, hit them from the sides or behind, pull up, curve around, and repeat the attack. Franz flipped up the metal spoon that guarded the 262's thumb trigger. His gloved thumb rested on the brown button that would ignite the 4 30-millimeter heavy cannons in the jet's nose. Franz used to tell his students what he had been told, that the cannons could chew through the wing of a B-17 with just 5 shells. He was ready to test the claim. The bombers were still tiny and far beyond range when Franz looked up and saw a sight that made his eyes bulge. Flying straight toward him and his comrades, high above, was a flock of silver fighters. He knew the silhouettes, long noses, straight wings, and narrow tails. He had shot one down the prior April. It was the fighter the Germans called the Flying Cross, the one the Americans called the Mustang. It was the P-51, and there were at least 100 of them. Franz knew he was in trouble. In his calm, professor-like voice, Steinhoff radioed, "Trouble above." A 262 could normally escape the P-51 and outrun it with ease. But if a P-51 was high above a 262, it could dive and pick up enough speed to briefly run with the jet. Looking up while shielding his eyes, Franz removed his finger from the trigger when he saw the P-51s diving. Franz looked up again and saw 3 P-51s breaking from the diving gaggle, their noses pointed straight at him. He knew this was a battle he could not win, and the others knew this too. The jets on Franz's left banked to the left, and Franz banked hard to the right. Franz would never get close enough to the bombers that day to see that they wore tail markings he would have recognized, the triangle K of the 379th Bomb Group. Rolling inverted, he instinctively turned to the tactic that had saved his life for 3 years in 109s. He dove. Aiming white 3 at the earth, he let her run like a rocket blazing through the atmosphere. The speed pinned him to his seat. Franz glimpsed the P-51s behind him, racing to catch up. Other P-51s swarmed his comrades. Franz pushed the trembling control stick forward to deepen the dive. The needle in the airspeed indicator quivered. Franz felt the G-forces piling their weight on his sternum. The voice of Lieutenant Farman shouted over the radio,
"Danube One, my horse is lame!"
Franz knew the code for engine trouble, and knew the P-51s had gotten Farman. Seconds later, he heard Farman say he was jumping. White Three raced faster and faster toward a layer of clouds at 20,000 feet. Franz's eyes watered. His airspeed indicator wound past the 600-mile-per-hour mark. The jet's red line was painted on the dial at the 625-mile-per-hour mark. When the needle reached that point, the jet's controls would freeze, and the craft could potentially break apart. Franz knew he had left the P-51s behind when clouds whipped past his canopy, revealing his blinding speed. Thanks to gravity and the turbojets, his 262 had become a bullet, ripping through 10,000 feet in seconds. As he burst through the clouds, the wide, patchwork fields below spread across Franz's windscreen in all directions. Franz decided he was safe with the clouds separating him from the fighting above. He tried to pull up, but the flight stick was frozen, locked by an evil spell. The cockpit turned silent. Only the sound of the wind howling across the wings told Franz he was alive. The speedometer's needle quivered at the 625-mile-per-hour mark. He had flown past the plane's limits. He had forgotten a rule of the 262, to never dive in a jet so fast it needed no help from gravity. Now, White 3 was frozen in a death dive. Franz struggled to pull the control stick, but it felt as unbending as an iron bar. Pinned to his seat, Franz knew he could not bail out. He felt himself grow cold as the thought struck him. "I just killed myself." Franz began to pray feverishly. "Kick the rudder." Franz thought he heard a voice, but his earphones were silent. Perhaps it was the voice of one of his instructors from jet school. Using the immovable control stick as leverage, Franz dug his heels into the rudder pedals. He pushed the left pedal forward with all his might. The jet shook from the tail. He pushed the right pedal. The jet shook again. Franz began kicking the rudder pedals, one then the other, until the jet's tail began to wag. Suddenly, Franz felt the control stick move. The jet tore through 10,000 feet, then 8,000 feet. Franz saw the farm fields ahead tighten in clarity, with crop lines and roads appearing. He wanted to rip back the throttle, but fought the urge. He kept kicking the rudder. He pulled back on the control stick, grunting and straining. He was certain the stick was about to snap. Slowly, White Three's nose twitched. Then it rose. Gritting his teeth and straining at the stick, Franz pulled the jet into a gentle arc. He saw the Earth approaching, 3,000 feet away, then 2,000, then 1,000. Franz knew it would be close, whether his pullout had enough arc to curve above the Earth. He stopped breathing but kept pulling. Just before the jet's underslung engines could scoop the soil, White Three's nose lifted upward and her engine's thrust blasted off the Earth. Regaining control, his altimeter at zero, as he flew along the field, Franz glanced to his left and saw the shocked faces of a group of farmers standing even with him. Climbing and turning, he caught his breath. Then he saw something incredible. The farmers were stomping flames that had broken out among the hay they had been laying out for their animals. His engines had made the ground catch fire. Franz flew past the farmers again and waved in apology. The farmers stopped and stared in wonder, too shocked to manage a reply. Their cows bolted from the jet's noise. The farmers returned to stomping. Turning for Munich, Franz flew past the plume of black smoke that rose from Ingolstadt, where the B-17s had struck an ordnance depot. He unzipped his black leather jacket. Sweating, Franz cursed himself for being so stupid. In the same breath, he thanked God for flying with him. His instructors had never warned him not to dive in the 262. No one could have experienced what he had and come back to warn of it. Franz would remember, "Later the next day, we actually had a briefing on my experience.
Remember that we were all still learning about these planes. This was a valuable lesson. Franz knew he had not pulled from that dive alone. Something had broken the evil spell, and it was a force more powerful than his muscles. 4 days later, April 9, 1945, around 4 o'clock p.m. Franz buried his shovel in the airfield's white, sandy soil and pitched the dirt aside. His foxhole was already 4 feet deep, but he kept digging. Next to him, White 3 sat in the late-day shadows on the other side of the blast pen's wall. Franz worked in his flying uniform because he knew he could be called to scramble at any moment. 4 days earlier, the Americans had found JV-44. When Franz flew home after barely recovering from his plane's death dive, he arrived over the field just after P-51s had strafed it. Everyone knew they would be back. The one-man foxholes were Gallant's idea, so the men could reach cover immediately upon landing. At the other blast pens leading east to the alert shack, the other pilots, Gallant included, were digging foxholes alongside the pens that housed their jets. Franz smirked at the irony that he was digging a grave, like the one he called home in Africa. A rapid, punctuated thump of machine guns froze Franz's foot to his shovel. Glancing west, he saw a P-51 burst over the trees, then dive to earth and race low toward the airfield. Another P-51 appeared, then another. Black and yellow checkerboards covered their noses, the war paint of the 353rd Fighter Group. The fighters swept across the southern edge of the field, their guns puffing. Their bullets chewed along the dirt and strafed up and over the blast pens and anti-aircraft gun pits. A parked jet exploded in flames. Anti-aircraft gunners fell dead over their earthen pits. The P-51 pilots hugged the ground, the air scoops beneath their bellies almost swiping the grass. Across Germany, enemy fighters had declared open season on German airfields, continuing 8 straight days of raids that would claim 1,697 German aircraft destroyed. Sirens wailed as the field's flak guns came to life and threw up rapid black clouds. The P-51s seemed to fly faster than their engine noise, a guttural growl that echoed after they had cleared the field. The P-51 pilots kept running east after each strike, staying low, not climbing or banking. Franz could tell they knew their craft. The first wave had barely departed when a second wave of P-51s burst through the smoke at the field's southern edge. They ripped north across the field at 320 miles per hour and strafed the planes parked in front of the terminal. Each time, the P-51s came from a new direction to confuse the flak gunners. For a moment, Franz stood still, his body frozen with alarm. The P-51s had hit everywhere except the flight line where he was standing. Men around Franz had jumped into their holes, ducked into blast pens, and sprinted for a bombed-out barn behind the alert shack. Franz found his feet, tossed his shovel aside, and jumped into his foxhole. Peering up at the sky, he saw ribbons of fire rip overhead. A shower of dirt told him he had moved just in time. A split second later, Franz looked up and saw a flight of P-51s fly directly over his head. Their prop blast blew off his hat. He could smell their exhaust. After the flak guns had chased the P-51s away, Franz slowly climbed out of his hole. 3 of the unit's jets lay burning around him, and others had caught bullets. Franz ran to check on his comrades, but miraculously, none had been hit. When Gallant came by, inspecting the damage, he lamented, "They would strafe a stray dog if they could." Franz climbed onto White 3's wings and walked from side to side. He smiled when he saw that she was unscathed. A siren stopped Franz. He jumped from his plane and into his hole, certain the P-51s were back. The other men along the flight line hid in their holes. Only their heads showed as they nervously glanced skyward. Franz waited for an order to take off, but none came. He waited in his hole next to White 3 until he heard a low rumble that he recognized from his time in Sicily, the droning of steel wasps.
Franz saw them emerge from the clouds high above. Box after box of silver bombers motored from south to north. They were B-17s, 200 planes strong. The flak guns of the airfield in the city of Munich blasted out, rocketing shells 30,000 feet up. Some of his comrades ran from their holes, but Franz stayed. He expected Gallant to come running to tell him to evacuate White 3. When Franz heard the high-pitched whine of bombs, he knew that no such order was coming. Franz put his thumbs in his ears and opened his mouth, just as the little girl had demonstrated in Potsdam. He squeezed his chest to his knees and huddled below ground as the earth shook. The pressure from each blast ripped over his hole and flung dirt down his back. His ears rang, his eyes watered. Each shockwave of pressure hit like an invisible foot on his back. Each blast sucked the breath from his lungs and stomped him deeper. Franz knew from the direction of the fury that the bombers were pounding the terminal and hangars where they expected JV-44 to live and operate. He heard glass shattering, fire sizzling, and walls slamming down. A bomber whined and spun toward the earth, but Franz never heard its crash over the chaos. A JV-44 officer, Major Werner Rohl, was in Munich and saw an airman parachute from the B-17. Rohl found the airman in the hands of civilians and an SS officer. Before the SS officer could execute the airman, Rohl chased the officer away and took the American to a hospital. The man might have worn a different uniform, but he was still a fellow human being. Rohl would remember. When the earth stopped shaking, Franz looked up from under his arm and saw the bombers turning west for home. He climbed from his hole and wiped his eyes. His comrades emerged, shaking the cobwebs from their heads. Across the airstrip, gray smoke rose from the terminal.